Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, Solartopia.
So we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
yes, indeed, we started to burn many things we found. That was the wonderful Dar Williams singing the Solartopia song with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Rivertown Kids, from the album Tomorrow's Children by Appleseed Records, won a Grammy, by God. We are back again for another hour with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I'm Harvey Wasserman. We're going to be joined today, I hope, by Paul Krasner. Paul, you around? Not there yet. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Oh, Paul, you are there.
Yes, yes.
All right. Well, wonderful. Well, I'm totally honored and thrilled and delighted to have the great Paul Krasner with us today. Paul is America's resident guerrilla satirist. And before we jump in, Paul, I want to give up my usual little nuclear power update, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I do have a piece today at Huffington Post entitled, Will You Pay As Our New Reactors Jump $900 Million in 3 Months? A pretty prosaic title, but we wanted to get the message in. The bottom line is we're talking here on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show pretty much every week about some aspect of the curse of nuclear power, something that's been a preoccupation of mine, or even an occupation or an avocation for the last, since 1973, that's more years than I can count. And we do appear to have the nuclear power industry on the run, finally, with reactors collapsing all over the world, the Fukushima catastrophe ongoing. We do have a spent fuel pool perched 100 feet in the air, which has people all over the planet justifiably freaked out, because if there is an earthquake, God forbid, at the Fukushima site, and we know there will be another one, that spent fuel pool at Unit 4 could come crashing to the ground. It would not be covered by water. It would catch fire, and it would spew more radiation into the atmosphere than has happened from any other human-made source, including Chernobyl by a long shot, and millions of people would be affected worldwide. I run a website called nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org, and I've been posting articles about nuclear power since 2007, and especially about Fukushima in the last year, and we just put one up. Senator Ron Wyden went to Japan, went to Fukushima, observed the nuclear plant there, and wrote a very, very disturbing memo about what could happen if, God forbid, these spent fuel rods went crashing to the ground. And it's something really worth reading. I've also posted today an article from a Japanese scientist who is warning that Fukushima will ultimately kill at least 1 million people. Now, we know that Chernobyl did that. We have a study done by three Russian, Soviet, ex-Soviet scientists who surveyed all the literature coming out about Fukushima about Chernobyl 25 years ago, and basically concluded that more than 985,000 people had died as a result. That's to date, had died as a result of fallout from Fukushima, from Chernobyl. And now, of course, we're dealing with fallout from Fukushima. It did come to California within a week. It has been detected in milk and on farm products all over the country, all over the United States. And it is a major health situation all over the world, really, and we have to deal with it. So this article today, posted at nukefree.org, basically says that we can expect at least 1 million fatalities as a result of Fukushima, and that is before we have to deal with the possibility of this spent fuel pool come crashing down. Now, my piece today at Huffington Post talks about the astonishing price hike that has happened at the Vogtle plant, V-O-G-T-L-E, in Georgia. The nuclear industry is building two reactors there, and they're jarring. They're using all their influence and money to get an $8.33 billion loan guarantee from the Federal Treasury. And Barack Obama at the DOE did promise this more than a year ago, but they haven't been able to negotiate terms. And now it turns out this two-reactor set that they want to build in Georgia, just in the last 3 months, jumped $900 million in price. And we think it's certainly approaching the level of $12 billion per reactor, which is nowhere near competitive with renewables, not even close. There's not even a worthwhile discussion to be had as to at that price as to whether nuclear power can stay in the same ballpark economically with solar-topian energy, solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, increased efficiency, all that great stuff. So if you're interested in that, it's at Huffington Post. Will you pay as new reactors jump $900 million in just 3 months? It's also at nukefree.org in my blog and the Common Dreams and the usual suspects. But take a look. I've also published near where Paul is. Paul, you live in Palm Desert, is that right?
No, that's one. The sign on the freeway says "Other Desert Cities," and I live in one of them.
Yeah. Is that incorporated?
I guess it is. At least the people that make those signs are a corporation.
Yeah. All right.
You know, I want to just make one quick bit of info to you that. I have a friend in Japan who's writing an article on the nuclear industry there, and so I've been sending this reporter your columns, among other material about it, that she doesn't know there, and so it's interesting because a lot of information to the U.S. From Japan comes from online that won't be in their official papers there, and then this is going back there, so it's kind of made a round trip, the information.
Well, good. I hope I get frequent farmhouse.
Yes. That's what the wireless industry takes care of.
You got it. Yeah, I was actually in Japan in 1975 and 76, speaking with anti-nuclear activists there, and everybody knew. I mean, it was not a mystery that these reactors were even built on earthquake faults in tidal wave zones.
You know,
everybody knew this could happen.
You know how the Republican primaries indicated that that people are willing to support laws and activities that are really against their own interests, and that's on a relatively low level, but it goes all the way up. I think there's a linear connection between that and the denial of what nuclear power can do. Even though they know it, they allow it to go on, I guess, so that people can go around and ignore reality.
Well, you know, I don't get it. I mean, there's a whole big article, a book actually written called What's the Matter with Kansas by a guy named Thomas Frank. And the whole thesis was that people in Kansas who are getting completely screwed by the corporations spend all the time worrying about gay marriage and preteen sex and smoking marijuana, and they're all going bankrupt because the government and the corporations are just, you know, raping and pillaging their livelihoods. I don't get it. Do you?
Well, yeah, I do, because I've dealt in my career with a lot of certifiably crazy people, and I even went through a psychotic episode myself when I had an overdose of information and misinformation when I was doing conspiracy research.
Is there a clinical treatment?
I understand how you can pass. So we're talking about this rationally, but you know, in four words, these people are nuts. You know,
yeah. Well, does that explain it? I mean, why are they nuts? Is it aspartame? Is it
They're victims of propaganda. You know, most of them watch Fox News as their gospel, and they can be very convinced. And then there's that psychological drive to justify a decision you've already made. And so it's a psychological process as much as and it's fueled by fear, certainly. The irony is that people like yourself and others I know who are active, are proactive, that I always think, why are we cheerful in our lives knowing what we do? And I've come to the conclusion that proactivity itself gives you a sense of optimism, even if it's a placebo. But placebos work.
Yeah, well, it was a great scene on a Saturday Night Live show a long time ago. Steve Martin was talking about his favorite drugs, and he said, "Oh, I'm really into those placebos, man." So, you took a couple of placebos in your life.
Because if you know they work, it's much cheaper. I'm putting out a brand myself called placebos for people who know that they're placebos, but they like to have something tangible to make the credibility a little stronger.
We're talking with Paul Krasner, America's resident guerrilla satirist, one of the truly great figures on the left and on the cultural left in America for, I won't say how many years, Paul, but you are 80, is that right?
I just had my 80th birthday.
Wow. Your age has exceeded my IQ now.
But, you know, it's weird. It's very weird. As my daughter said, Holly said to me, "Dad, that's crazy." And I said, "Yeah, I know, but you can't fight chronology." So,
That's a good one. You can't fight chronology. Let me make a good bumper sticker. Let me explain to some people about Paul Krasner. Paul, you were influenced by Mad Magazine in your youth, or you influenced Mad Magazine. Actually, I was influenced by Mad Magazine. You influenced Mad Magazine. You were a part of the subculture in New York there, humorists and satirists and cartoonists and leftists and comedians who just took on the establishment in a cultural way. And you knew the guys who did Mad Magazine, is that right?
Well, yeah, the thing is, I was not a cartoonist, though. What I would do is the first art piece I wrote for them, I was a freelancer, I wasn't on the staff. The first
piece
I wrote...
So you wrote freelance for Mad Magazine?
Huh?
You wrote freelance for Mad Magazine?
So the first piece was... if comic book characters answered those little ads in the back of magazines. And they don't have those kind of ads today, but in those days they had like ads to get a nose job. And so I had Dick Tracy going to a plastic surgeon for a nose job. And Orphan Annie answered an ad for Maybelline because her eyes were just empty ovals. And
they printed it and they paid you.
And
do you have it in your archives?
Probably somewhere. My archives is just a euphemism for all the crap in my garage. So it's lucky I never threw anything away, I suppose. And then the editor of Mad would assign that article when I wrote the script. And they would assign that to an artist. In this case, it was the late Wally Wood, who in later years did, for The Realist, the Disneyland Memorial Orgy poster. So
So let's talk about the Disneyland Memorial Orgy poster. Probably the most
infamous. Let me just give you the transition.
Please.
Which is that as I started giving Mad other things, to publish, and they said it was too adult.
And, too adult?
In the sense of their audience, I had things about atomic testing, actually, and they didn't want to do that. I had a thing about the pros and cons of unions. They didn't want to do that. So that, you know, so they were topics for grown-ups, they figured.
Well, what years were these?
This was the early 50s, about 1955, maybe.
When did Mad Magazine start? Was it around then? 1955 or so?
Well, Well, the magazine started a little bit, had started around that time, but it had been a comic book before that. But because they would, and a comic book association was formed to get a seal of approval, that would have taken away the impact of Mad Comics because they were, their whole essence was irreverence. And I was working for Lyle Stewart then, who ran The Independent, which was a precursor to the alternative press, part of a tradition that goes way back to George Seldes, in fact, and all the way back to Tom Paine during the Revolution. And so so Lyle Stewart wrote to Bill Gaines, who was the publisher of Mad, that he was a fan of his, not knowing that Bill Gaines had been reading The Independent, Lyle Stewart's paper, and he wrote back and signed it in awe, Bill Gaines. So they met, uh-huh. had lunch, and we moved the office from The Independent down to the Mad Building on Lafayette Street.
There was a Mad Building?
Well, it was called the Mad Building just because they were the biggest clients who had offices there. And so we got an office.
Still there?
No, they moved to Madison Avenue.
Oh, okay.
But I stayed in that building. Sentimentality.
Uh-huh.
And so the realist, one of the biggest triggers of it was, that there was no satirical magazine then, for adults. You know, they had a cartoon now and then in the New Yorker that really made a statement. But and there was a publication called Monocle, which was published by graduate students from Yale. That didn't last too long. And there was an article in Esquire magazine called America Needs a Punch, a punch in italics because it was the name of the English humor magazine, and the article was by its editor, Malcolm Muggeridge. And so I took that as my marching orders, to have an equivalent to Punch in America. So, I think that's the audience it got, people who had outgrown Mad Magazine and wanted stuff that would also, you know, besides little silly things, they were good and they were clever, but they didn't get to the core of what was on people's minds.
Well, when I was about 13, I went over to Robbie Orner's house, and he had a copy of Mad Magazine that had Alfred E. Newman, who's missing a front tooth, as I am now. He was standing on a wedding cake, and you saw the bride walking off the cake, furious about something, maybe what an adult Alfred E. Newman was. And when I read that magazine, it was like my first acid trip. I mean, it was just a complete revelation in Columbus, Ohio, to read this magazine full of New York satire and poking fun at everything, and very funny. And you know, I totally fell in love with Mad Magazine, and that's when I became a hippie.
Oh,
and
but
I
you
think
know, you know,
the, a lot of people.
You know, the backstory of well, you know, it was you could make a choice between whether you want to hang around with a kid who read Mad Magazine or the Boy Scout manual.
What if you were both? You could have been a gay Mad Magazine reader.
Well, you know, that's the backstory for the bride walking off the cake. She was so dismayed by the thought of same-sex marriage that it ruined her desire to be married heterosexually, and she just walked off the cake.
Really?
No. No, I just thought of that now. when you presented that image.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe the two of them had just dropped acid. And Alfred E. Or this was way. Well, actually, no. Acid started in what, 46, 47. No one was really taking it recreationally.
Well, the CIA was, but
the CIA was. But that, and I guess you could. I mean, they really were being recreational about it. But you know,
Of course, you never took acid, right, Paul? Except when you were testifying at the Chicago 8 trial in front of Julius and Abby Hoffman. Then you took acid. And who got madder at you, Julius or Abby?
Well, Abby knew that I had swallowed a tab of acid, so he got angrier.
Uh-huh.
You know, he stopped speaking to me for 10 months. And I could see it from his point of view. It was as if I'd betrayed, you know, they were facing prison time. But he was the one who coached me the previous night. You know, on one hand, he said, now, the testimony, you have to give the same testimony that we gave, consistency. So you can't help us, but you can only harm us. But then he also said, I want you to make Judge Hoffman go have a heart attack. So I would say that was mixed messages.
All right. We're on with Paul Krasner, the founder of the Realist magazine, and the great satirical magazine that published from when to when, Paul?
It started in 1958, suspended in 1974, and then came back in 1985, and then I retired it in 2001.
Wow, what a run. That's fantastic. And you, of course, published two of the most infamous pieces of American literature ever published. I mean, and I say that advisedly, having read a lot of American literature. You published the story that purported to show Lyndon Johnson abusing, is probably the politest term I could use, abusing the corpse of John Kennedy in Air Force One on the way back from Dallas. And then you also published the infamous and probably one of the great pieces of all visual art ever produced in the United States, the full-page spread, and I use the word spread advisedly, drawn by Wally Wood, formerly of Mad Magazine, portraying the primary Disney characters, ranging from Snow White and Cinderella to Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, engaged in an orgy involving drugs and sex. And also Dumbo defecating from the air on, I think, Donald Duck. Those are the two most amazing pieces of literature, I think, that came out of the counterculture in that era. And you had your fingerprints all over both of them, Paul Krasner. What do you think?
Well, actually, the idea came to me when Disney died, and I had empathy for all his characters. Who were now mourning in suspended animation, literally, and because you know, to them, Walt Disney had been their intelligent designer,
mm-hmm.
and now that their creator was gone, they could go on a royal binge because their libidos were no longer being repressed, and so I called Wally Wood and just described. That background, I didn't give anything specific because
you didn't tell him that you know, Mickey should be shooting up, or there should be a gang rape of which one? It was Snow White being gang raped. I don't remember, by the dwarfs, the seven dwarfs.
Well, I didn't look. It didn't look at like rape to me. It looked like she was enjoying it. But anyway,
Wait. You're saying that? Well, you better be careful there. I mean, a lot of feminists would take offense to the idea that Snow White was enjoying having
sex people can judge
simultaneously with the seven dwarfs, who were also politically incorrectly named.
In 2005, a former employee of the Disney Corporation, who would prefer to be anonymous, digitally colored that poster, which was originally black and white. In fact, your listeners can see what it looks like.
Actually, they can order it, right? Why don't you tell people how they can order? We have a lot of younger listeners who may never have seen this poster. I know it's hard to believe. This is, ladies and gentlemen, this is the most amazing poster you will ever see in your life. It is, 8.5 by 14? And it is a full spread. Of Disney characters, all the great Disney characters being involving themselves in acts of carnival knowledge and drug taking and the whole deal. And Mickey looks like a street urchin shooting up Give us a little more description. Tell people how to get this thing.
Let's see. Who else? Tinkerbell is doing the striptease.
Yeah, that stands. Well, you know,
as Pinocchio watches it, his nose gets longer.
So Pinocchio is watching Tinkerbell strip, and his nose gets longer. What else we got?
Let's see. Goofy and Minnie Mouse are having sexual intercourse on a big combination bed and cash register.
The implication being that Minnie is for hire.
Not necessarily. It meant that Disneyland was for hire.
Deeper symbolism. Okay.
So people could just see it for themselves on my website, paulkrasner.com, and it has two S's.
PaulKrasner.com, yeah.
Right, and that's my website.
Now, do you sell this poster for what's
the cover? Details are there.
Uh-huh, okay.
It's the first thing that pops up on my homepage.
Wonderful. And there's still demand for it? You still sell a few here and there?
Oh, yeah. And I always ask the people, how they learned of my website. And a lot of them said they had the original poster, and their mothers ripped it off the wall, and so they finally Googled me and the Disneyland Memorial Orgy poster, and that linked it to my website. So it continues to sell because people had fond memories of it, or they don't feel that Disneyland is one of the great wonders of the world. Like a nice little steady stream comes in that helps buy the groceries.
Well, that's good. So you're still in it. When did this come out?
Originally, in the magazine, it came out in May 1967.
So this has been selling now for 34
well, no,
years.
Well, no. I ran out of copies at a certain point. I found a couple in my garage. Excuse me, I mean among my archives.
Your temperature controlled, humidity regulated. Of course, you're in the desert, but humidity related garage there.
And found a printer who had once worked at Disneyland, and so he just without my asking, he started. Doing this digital culling, what he called authentic Disney colors of his characters, and I always thought these characters would be like pallbearers, even though there's that urban myth that Disney was frozen, but he was not frozen.
He wasn't.
No, it's an urban myth, but that's the thing about it's much more fun to believe that he was just buried like a.
Well, they froze Ted Williams' head, hoping he might hit 406 again.
Oh, they froze, or they wanted to freeze Timothy Leary's head,
but he wouldn't give them head.
Well, he just said he had thought about it, and then he realized he didn't want to wake up to a bunch of guys holding writing stuff on clipboards. But these guys, Ted Williams, Tim Leary, and anybody else, I think they could have a great afterlife with a new TV program of celebrity bowling.
We are talking with Paul Krasner, America's resident guerrilla satirist, originator of the realist and the infamous Wallywood poster of the Disney character Orgy. We're going to take a short break and come back. Paul, you're always really a trip. When we come back, we'll have about a 30-second slot of the wit and wisdom of Mitt Romney, and then we'll move on to stuff that's actually that we can talk about. We'll be right back. Topia, that's Dana Cows with Guns Lions singing the second of our two theme songs, the first by Pete Seeger, Dar Williams, and David Burns. We are at the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show with the wonderful Paul Krasner speaking to us from the deserts of California. Paul is
America's resident guerrilla satirist. He's been on the case since the 1950s. Did the Realist magazine and the infamous, in the 1960s, the infamous description of, I can't even begin to describe, Lyndon Johnson, shall we say, abusing the corpse of John Kennedy on Air Force One. And then they were pretty close to each other, weren't they? Then the satire, the brilliant and spectacular cartoon of the Disney characters engaging in sexual and other immoral behavior. What were the relative dates of these two events? These two masterpieces of American art, let's put it that way.
The parts left out of the Kennedy book was going to be published in March 1967, but my printer refused to print it, and I went around. I spent 2 months trying to find a printer for it, and I went to the printer that did the Communist Party periodical, and they wouldn't do it. I mean, even communists wanted to be respectable.
I guess. So, well, more, yeah, I mean, God, communists, you know, what bunch of tight.
So, but I finally found a printer in, I know that in the internet age now, you say, I found a printer. They say, where'd you get it, at Best Buy or online? but right. This was a human printer man person who had a printing plant with machinery. And
Why would he do it and no one else?
He believed in the First Amendment. That was
what a novel idea.
Yeah,
a printer who believes in the First Amendment. Can you imagine?
It was in the May 67 issue. And actually, in the same issue was the Disneyland Memorial Orgy as a center spread in the two middle pages.
Wow. Now, can people get this historic edition of The Realist?
One of my books has reprinted it, and there's still copies available on my website. It's a book called The Winner of the Slow Bicycle Race, and it was a collection of my satire, and Kurt Vonnegut did the introduction, and that includes the actual article that was originally published.
And the spread, the Disney spread?
They can see that on the online thing, on my website, and that's the color version.
Okay, great. Now, I don't usually push products, but, you know, I love this Disney spread. I thought it was the funniest thing I ever saw in my life. It was greatly liberating to see it back in the 60s when, you know, Disney was still a presence, let's put it that way, and more than worthy of being totally lampooned. He was a very right-wing guy, not a particularly nice guy when it came to the war in Vietnam or other kinds of progressive politics, and one of those self-made guys. I found out, by the way, this was a great thing to learn, that Ayn Rand, the great perpetrator of individualism and Howard Roark and the Fountainhead and all this stuff, actually went on Medicare in her later life. I loved all these Tea Party people running around denouncing government programs and on Medicare and getting Social Security, and that was Ayn Rand.
And also, she was an atheist, and these are from all of these, fundamentalists who think that she's the savior, besides Jesus. But she didn't even believe in Jesus herself, because she believed in herself so hard that there was no room left.
Right. Well, she and Jesus, I think, went out together. But anyway, so, Paul, you have made a career, a lifetime of poking fun and doing an incredibly brilliant job of it. And you were a principal at the Chicago Convention in 1968, where I got whacked twice, and you named the Youth International Party, or the Yippie Party. Can you tell us about that?
Well, as a journalist, I knew that media needed a who for their who, what, where, and why.
Hmm.
Wait, no, who, when, where, what, and why.
Who, what, when, what, when, who, why, whatever.
Okay. Yeah, the five
whatever,
W's.
One of those things.
And or sometimes it was who? How instead of why. And so that's where the expression came from, and how. And so the... and so we were having a meeting. This was on the issue, the December 31st, on the afternoon of that, 1967. And we were having a meeting.
Wait, December 31st, 1967 is when you came up with Youth International Party?
Yeah.
That was actually my 21st birthday, but we will...
Oh, well,
birthday,
consider it a present in retrospect.
There you go. No, it was a great present. I still have a yippie button, actually, stuck to my wall.
So so we were just sitting around talking about, you know, we wanted to have rock bands play while the convention was having stump speeches. We wanted to have information booths around at our counter convention, you know, for information about the draft, information about drugs, but we weren't decided, and I just knew we had to have a name for it, and I felt a brainstorm coming on, and this was at Abby and Anita Hoffman's apartment on the Lower East Side, and I just went into the bedroom to try and see, concentrate on what was swirling around in my mind. I knew it was like a search for a name that would be, would at least would rhyme with hippies. Because what it really meant was, you know, that would signify the radicalization of hippies.
Uh-huh.
And so I started going through the alphabet, ippy, bippy, sippy, dippy, ippy, fippy, gippy. And I was about to give up when I came to the near end of the alphabet, and I said, yippy. And I said, and I knew it. There was no question about it.
Uh-huh.
And so I had to work backwards to see how I could come... how it would come back to yippies organically. And so I thought, okay, if the initials, you know, YIP would be perfect because yippies could come out of that organically, then I had to go backwards further and say, okay, what do those letters stand for? And why youth? Because it was essentially then a youth movement. And
this is at the Chicago Democratic Convention in 1968, where the police went totally crazy and beat the crap out of as many people as they could get their hands on.
In an official government report, it was labeled as a police riot.
Right.
And so then I thought then I, the letter I would be international, because it wasn't this. Rebellion was just going on in the States. It was going on in Mexico, in Paris, and Czechoslovakia,
yeah.
Czechoslovakia, you know, around the globe. There was an evolutionary jump in consciousness, and mm-hmm. it went around the planet. And then the letter
kind
P...
Kind of makes you believe in astrology, doesn't it?
Huh?
Kind of makes you believe in astrology, in a way, because it was all happening at the same time. I remember when we were running through the streets of Chicago... we were yelling two things. The whole world was watching, and then we were yelling stuff about Czechoslovakia, which at the time was being also in rebellion.
Oh, and that confused a lot of people who kept thinking that the Communist Party was behind the yippies, and then they would see us marching in support of the revolution in Czechoslovakia. I mean,
against communism.
Against communism, right? So that confused them.
Yeah.
And so, instead of the letter P, would be party, and it was perfect because we would be like as if a political party, and we nominated a pig for president in Chicago. And
yeah,
also,
what was the name of the pig?
Pegasus.
Pegasus, that's right.
And also...
it was a kosher pig, as I recall.
Well, it depended. You know, I think they had a fake rabbi, so it doesn't count.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, and so the other aspect of the letter P was party, and that's what it was too. And I think it was summed up by what our mission statement was. It was summed up by Phil Oakes, who said, "A demonstration should turn you on, not turn you off."
Uh-huh. And Phil Oakes, I remember at that convention, I was 20 something, 21, 22.
And there was a gathering on the south side of Chicago in the hall where Woodrow Wilson, my least favorite president, had been nominated in 1916 to run against Eugene V. Debs. And Phil Tseng, there were, I don't know, a couple thousand people in there. You were probably there, yeah? Phil Tseng got up and he sang I Ain't Marching Anymore, which was his great anthem. And I remember I was christened to see him, and when he started singing that song, the crowd went completely crazy, and the energy from the crowd almost knocked him off the stage. I mean, he was like, you know that ad where the guy is sitting in the armchair and there's a speaker that's blowing his hair and his tie. Well, the energy from the crowd when he started singing I Ain't Marching just basically blew him back from the front of the stage. It was astounding.
Well,
one of the great moments of my activist career.
Oh, absolutely. This was in Chicago at part of our counter convention. That's
yeah, 1968.
And this was it was an unbirthday party for Lyndon Johnson.
Oh.
And it was held in the Coliseum, it was called.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And when Phil did that, started singing I Ain't Marching Anymore, You'd see somebody in the audience lighting a draft card.
That's correct.
And then somebody else did it. And then somebody else. And then you could see it. I was backstage, and I was watching it. It was an incredible image that literally burned into my memory. And you used to see all these draft cards being burned around, and Phil was seeing it, too. And he was astounded. And so when he finished and he walked off and we embraced and he said to me, that was the most exciting moment of my career.
Oh, yeah.
And then I had to follow him as a speaker. And
speaker, that must have been really... So what did you do? What did you say? What could you possibly say after that?
I think I talked about... A lot of photostats made of my draft card because I was speaking at different colleges and anti-war rallies, and I needed extra copies because I would burn it. And so, in fact, I did that at the expo. It was like a world fair in Montreal, and I was being interviewed, And I burned it there. And there was a Marine who was standing there very straight. He had gone to protocol school, and he was a lieutenant. And he called the captain, who came to see me when the interview was over. And he said, the lieutenant says that you burned your draft card. And I said, here it is. And I took my real draft card out and showed it to him. And the lieutenant, he got all flabbergasted. I saw him, sir. I saw him. He burned his ground. I saw him. And I said, no. I said, that was a photostat of my draft card. And the captain says to me, well, you know, it's against the law to destroy I'm sorry. He said, it's against the law to burn a facsimile or something like that. And I said, well, you know, I destroyed the evidence. And he didn't know what to say. So,
plus you were in Canada, so he was a little out of his range.
Oh, well, it became a free speech issue because it was taped and it was going to be on the news there that night. And there were people who wanted to stop it, but the station fought them.
The burning of your facsimile of your draft card?
Yeah, there was not supposed to be any demonstrations at the expo, but I smuggled one in.
Uh-huh.
And I was tripping then, by the way. I remember the interviewer said to me, well, what do you think of this expo so far? And we were in a giant dome, a Buckminster Fuller type dome, a gigantic. And I was looking around and I said, oh, this is a great, a geodesic dome, I think it was called. And the beautiful colors flowing across. I said, you probably don't see them, do you?
And
he said, no, I don't, Paul. So to go back to Phil of the audience, you know, he was thrilled. And then I spoke about a reporter who was there, but obviously I didn't name him, who had interviewed Lyndon Johnson, and after the interview was over, Johnson said to him, "You know what the commies are saying? They're saying bleep you, Lyndon Johnson, and nobody says bleep you to Lyndon Johnson and gets away with it."
Yeah.
And I told that story. And I told that story there, and I said, "Well, we're going to say it now, and we're going to get away with it." And I started counting, not knowing what to expect. 1, 2, 3. And virtually everybody there, not just the yippies, but the Clean for Gene McCarthy followers, the mobilization against the war people. I mean, it was just a feeling of really being united. And it came back at me like a tsunami or a tornado or a hurricane, you know, this rolling huge wave from the audience, from the rafters, and it just... the whole crowd saying in unison, "Bleep you, Lyndon Johnson," and then laughed and applauded. And when I went backstage, Phil Oakes was there. We embraced again, and I said, "That was the most exciting moment of my career."
We are talking with Paul Krasner, America's guerrilla satirist, publisher of the wonderful The Realist paper, a number of books. What's your most recent book, Paul?
Let's see. The most recent one was called "Who's to Say What's Obscene: Politics, Culture, and Comedy Today." But there's a couple of a little older ones. But there was one great collection called "Murder at the Conspiracy Convention," and George Carlin did the introduction to that, and that's on the website. And I have two books coming out this month.
Two books in a month?
I'm sorry, in the same year. Time flies when you're 80.
Yeah. What are they? What are the books?
They're both updated and expanded editions. So one is Pot Stories for the Soul, and it's just a bunch of pot stories from...
marijuana.
Yeah, all about different aspects of it, by and about Ken Kesey and Hunter Thompson and Wavy Gravy and Michelle Phillips and a lot of people that we never heard of, but as well as countercultural celebs, and that has an introduction by the prolific science fiction writer Harlan Ellison, who was against it. He wrote an anti-marijuana introduction, and I thought, that's perfect. And
what
so that'll
be out.
What
did he say against marijuana?
Huh? What?
What did he say against it?
Well, because he never took it. He had such a great life without getting high. So.
Well, that was his point?
Yeah. So, no, he wouldn't want to prevent anybody from doing it.
Uh-huh.
And that'll be out in June.
What's it called again?
Pot Stories for the Soul.
Okay.
And we heard when it was originally published in 1999, it was the publisher got a letter from the attorneys for the Chicken Soup for the Soul people, asking them to cease and desist. But anyway, you know, I mean, scientists and theologians alike agree that the soul cannot be located, but apparently it could be copyrighted. So anyway, the other book was originally published by Simon & Schuster in 1993, my autobiography called Confessions of a Raving Unconfined Nut.
And that term came from the FBI, right?
When Life magazine had a profile of me, and in the counterintelligence department of the FBI, they had a guy who, he just made up a name, Howard Rasmussen, School of General Studies, Brooklyn College, New York, you know, just to give it a certain credibility. And he wrote that it's just too cute to call Paul Krasner a social rebel. He's a nut, a raving, unconfined nut.
And of course, they wanted to confine you.
Well, they wanted to, you know, I wasn't doing anything illegal. They just thought they wanted to hurt my reputation. But, you know, I've been called worse than that, so it didn't concern me. My favorite headline about me was, give this man a saliva test.
Where was that?
I guess we had to give you a blood test. I don't know.
Did they give you a saliva test?
No, I just made that up.
Okay.
But maybe they do if you ask.
Yeah, well, we're talking with Paul Krasner, the originator of the Realist magazine, the originator of the, two of the great pieces of literature and art in American history, the scene, both in the same issue. What was the issue? Do you remember what year and what date the issue was that they were in?
May 1967.
The May 1967, that was the day, issue of The Realist features the full 8.5 by 17 spread of the sex orgy involving all the great Disney characters, and
that's the black and white one. But they can see. Oh, I didn't mention to you that an artist from Austin has posted all of the issues from beginning to end online.
Of The Realist.
Yeah, just
how many were there?
146 altogether, uh-huh. I think it was. And all you have to do is Google The Realist Archive Project.
And they're all there?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Now, did you put up any of your original Mad Magazine pieces?
No, I didn't.
That might be fun, but anyway,
I don't even know if they were ever put online. You know, they didn't have PCs or Macs.
Just think if The Realist had been on the internet and you had spread through the internet the description of Lyndon Johnson abusing the corpse of John Kennedy. How do you think that would have played out on the internet? Actually, you could do it now. People probably wouldn't, you know, a whole new generation would know what the hell, where it came from.
Well, not only that. I mean, this was an act of presidential necrophilia. But I met a 25-year-old musician who told me that she really believed it to be true because of all the other weird stuff that was happening.
Right. Well, maybe it was true.
Well, it was. But, you know, I don't know if abuse is a fair word because, for all we know, it might have been an act of love.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people think Lyndon Johnson actually did kill John Kennedy.
There was that suspicion, yeah.
Still is. You know, you can talk to a lot of people who still think that LBJ did him in. Paul, way back when, you knew Lenny Bruce, who was kind of viewed as the godfather of what? How would you describe Lenny Bruce?
Well, he was sort of a pioneer because he broke through the tradition of the old-time comics who did jokes about the mother-in-law, the wife's cooking, the Asian drivers, you know, all the stereotypes, the airplane food jokes. And now, of course, they don't give you food on airplanes. So there goes a whole joke right down
right.
the drain.
Yeah, a whole
genre. Putting a lot of people out of jobs.
Disappeared.
And so he did material about the low salaries of teachers compared with show business celebrities. He talked about the atomic bomb testing. He talked about racism. He talked about abortion rights. All of these things that were going on that the truth could be told about them through satire. Satire was a vehicle for so that when people would laugh, and then they would realize that they were laughing at the truth and satire became the same process, and so it was a vehicle for revealing truth.
Politically a radical?
He would make fun. He would make fun of. Conservatives and liberals alike, if you felt they deserved it.
And certainly they did. We are actually getting unbelievable. This just flew by. We're getting near the end of the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. Paul, give people, if you would, your website again and what's available there and your book.
PaulKrasner.com with two S's. You can check it out, and you can see the Disneyland Memorial Orgy poster at the digitally colored edition, and a few books I have, including Murder at the Conspiracy Convention with George Carlin's intro.
Paul, you're a great friend and a truly a wonderful national treasure here, so we just have to have you back. Thanks so much for being with us on the Soulotopia Green Power and Wellness Show. This is Harvey Wasserman signing off from another hour. We will have Paul Krasner back if he's willing to come and get your own edition of the Disney Memorial Orgy poster. Freak out your children and your grandchildren by writing paulkrasner.com. Thank you so much, Paul, and we'll be back next week for another hour. Thank
all right,
you, Matt.
It takes the national treasure to recognize one.
Well, thank you so much. We will talk again. And no nukes, everybody.
The poor got so, the fuel ran scarce, the price jumped high, and so they gave nuclear power a try. But
don't you know it's gone?